Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Friday, March 27th. I'm Taylor Heckert. The Alaska Board of Fisheries last weekend voted down three proposals to limit hatchery production of pink and chum salmon. Those hatcheries are mostly in Southeast and Prince William Sound. They're run by private nonprofits, and the state manages their permits. The Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory Committee sought a 25% reduction in egg production per hatchery permit. That's a proposal they've recommended before. Board of Fish member Mike Wood of Talkeetna discussed the pros and cons.
By cutting 25% of hatchery production in areas like Prince William Sound or Southeast, is a squeeze worth the juice with the impacts that it would have on these small boat fishermen, on an industry that we really need to rely on in this state?
The board decided no and rejected the proposal 6-1. Two other proposals to limit pink and chum hatchery production came from the Kenai River Sports Fishing Association. Kevin Delaney with the group said they're concerned that hatchery salmon compete with wild stocks. A study from 2023 suggests there may not be enough ocean food for all of them.
We believe it's overwhelmingly on the side that there are impacts to wild stocks as a result of the magnitude of hatchery production in pink and chum in Alaska.
One of the group's proposals targeted hatcheries in Prince William Sound. That failed by a large margin. But another proposal triggered a split vote and lots of discussion. It would have capped pink and chum salmon permits at last year's levels by limiting egg take at those hatcheries. Advocates say this would allow the state time to further investigate if hatchery pinks and chums affect wild stocks and by how much. Board member Olivia Irwin of Nanana supported the proposal, saying it would give the state time to research the potential problem.
There is no definitive proof that our wild stocks are not being adversely affected or impacted by hatchery fish.
But the proposal ultimately received no action by the board, with a vote of 4-3, meaning it doesn't advance. Fish and Game also opposed the proposal. Since Juneau broke its official winter snowfall record at the airport on Monday, many people have asked, will the melting snowpack influence the next glacial outburst flood expected in the Mendenhall Valley this summer? KTOO's Alex Solomon talked to the scientists with the answer.
The short answer is no. Local scientists say this winter's snowfall won't really have much, if any, influence on Juneau's next glacial outburst flood. Let's explain. First, there's an important distinction between snowfall, which is added up on a daily basis, and snowpack, the layers that stack up and compress over the whole winter. The capital city broke its snowfall record at the Juneau International Airport with a little more than 200 inches on March 23rd. But Aaron Jacobs, a hydrologist at the National Weather Service in Juneau, says the snowpack and the water that it'll melt down to is pretty close to average.
The amount of water that's in the snowpack is about near normal. Nothing very extraordinary. Not very high.
That's according to snowpack data tracked by the U.S. Natural Resources Conservation Service at two stations near Juneau. Aaron Hood is a glacial outburst flood expert at the University of Alaska Southeast. He says the snowpack isn't deeper because there was a long warm-up in the middle of winter when a lot of it melted.
There's the first sort of snowpocalypse and then this melt-out period and then the second snowpocalypse.
But more importantly, Hood says Juneau's snowpack is completely unrelated to the conditions that control the size of glacial outburst floods, unlike spring floods in parts of the western U.S. Suicide Basin is the lake beside Mendenhall Glacier that produces Juneau's annual glacial outburst flood when it fills up and then bursts through the ice, releasing around 16 billion gallons of water all at once into the suburban Mendenhall Valley below. Hood says heavy summer rainfall contributes the most to how quickly Suicide Basin fills up, since it both adds water directly and rapidly melts ice. But he says in a year where there's a particularly large snowpack to melt, the basin might fill a bit sooner.
Maybe instead of early August, we could fill it by, say, the third week of July. Would that influence how big the flood was? No. What influences how big the flood is the volume of the basin when it's full and how fast the water is released.
And he says those two variables have nothing to do with how quickly the basin fills. So where are we at with the basin volume and how fast the floodwaters burst out, which actually control the size of the flood? Scientists don't know yet. Hood says that in the winter, glacial ice flow rates are slow, and massive icebergs aren't calving into Suicide Basin.
I don't think there's a lot of activity over winter in terms of the basin volume changing substantially. I wouldn't expect that.
He says his team plans to do drone surveys of Suicide Basin in May and June that will allow them to update the estimated volume of water it can hold. And as for how fast the water bursts from the basin and rushes through the Mendenhall River, scientists can't measure that until the flood is underway. The size of the flood has consistently grown over the last 3 years. But even if the next flood is the biggest one yet, this winter's snow wouldn't be why. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
Developers of the Alaska LNG project are pressing lawmakers to pass a tax bill proposed by Governor Mike Dunleavy last week. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and its private sector partner Glenfarne told lawmakers Wednesday Dunleavy's proposal to replace property taxes with a tax based on pipeline throughput is an essential step to moving the pipeline forward. Glenfarne's Alaska head, Adam Prestige, told lawmakers the tax proposal would drive down the cost of gas, both for in-state consumers and the liquefied natural gas export market.
This alternative tax proposal is a key element in doing that. Anytime you have a major cost associated with a project, that cost is ultimately borne by those who pay for the gas.
The state's current property tax on oil and gas infrastructure is equivalent to an annual tax of 2% of the project's value. But Prestige and other advocates for the gas line say that's an order of magnitude higher than the tax similar projects pay in other markets. The state's Department of Revenue's chief economist, Dan Stickle, projects the tax change would reduce the cost of gas by 9%. Stickle says it would also cut state and local revenue from the gas pipeline, but Stickle offered a key caveat.
The developer and the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation have stated that the project will not go forward without property tax relief.
Glenfarne, however, doesn't appear ready for quite that hard a sell. A spokesperson for the company would not confirm that property tax relief is make or break for the project as a whole. But the spokesperson pointed to numerous analysis presented by the legislature that had identified the 20 mil property tax as a major barrier to a gas pipeline. Governor Mike Dunleavy, in an interview with KDLL in Kenai on Friday, put it more bluntly.
Zero times 20 mils is what? Zero. You don't get anything if there's no project. There's nothing.
The bill needs a majority vote in the House and Senate and the consent of the governor to become law. But legislators from both parties say they're frustrated with the fast timeline, with less than 2 months remaining in the legislative session. Representative Donna Mears, an Anchorage Democrat, says she's concerned that legislators only have a years-old estimate of the project's total cost. That's $46 billion, a 2023 estimate adjusted for inflation. She says that makes it hard to evaluate whether the bill represents a good deal for Alaskans.
There's real costs that are being developed by the project developer that neither the Department of Revenue nor us as legislators have. So we're being asked to make decisions on a number that is not real. And that does not include the potential for cost overruns. We don't have enough information.
Glenfarne has said publicizing specifics like overall cost estimates could compromise negotiations with other private sector partners. But an executive with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, who said he was familiar with current cost estimates, said the $46 billion number was, quote, within reason. Some other legislators say they were concerned about the tax break's impact on local governments that would host the gas line. Local officials are scheduled to discuss the proposal with the Senate Resources Committee today. So you've just completed the frigid 1,000-mile Iditarod Trail sled dog race. What happens next? KNOM's Ben Townsend tagged along with Iditarod veteran Gabe Dunham to find out.
As frost slowly forms on her eyelashes, Gabe Dunham checks on her team in the so-called dog lot of the Iditarod. It's just down the road from the race's Burled Arch finish line. The specially bred dog athletes lay in crates stuffed with straw to keep them warm and cozy.
That one's Usher.
He's one of your leads, right?
Yeah. Super great dog.
After completing the 1,000-mile endurance race, the dog team's metabolisms are still on overdrive. Dunham says while they wind down, she feeds them what they would normally eat out on trail, including 10 pounds of ground beef fat a day.
Every year, the dogs kind of change up their idea of what I should be cooking them.
How do you know
and
that?
So you figure it out on the trail. Like, you'll make something with a slight difference to it, and all of a sudden they just smash it. They're like, that was delicious. So you're like, okay, we'll stay with delicious. Here's the Alaska Airlines vehicle.
A white box truck arrives, and Alaska Airlines chief dispatcher Rick J. Bush hops out the front seat and slides up the back door of the truck.
Hello. How are you doing?
Oh, cold.
It is cold.
How many dogs we got?
We've got 11 dogs.
11 dogs and a sled?
And a sled.
J. Bush says he first got involved with Iditarod Logistics in 2003. These days, it's just him helping load dog teams onto Alaska Airlines' fleet of cargo jets. Transportation costs aren't included in the Iditarod standard $4,000 entry fee, so mushers like Dunham pick from a handful of options like Alaska Airlines or Linden.
I was shocked to hear that it was only $500 to fly everybody home. But, like, to give you an idea, it cost me $500 just to ship empty crates up here.
Hey, you come on out of here.
One by one, the dogs are removed from their crates and the straw inside is dumped out. It's a fire hazard, J. Bush says. The crate then goes into the back of the box truck. A dog is loaded into it and slid to the side, leaving a narrow alleyway. The process is repeated until all 11 of Dunham's dogs are aboard. The dogs go on a short drive to the Nome Airport, where a giant metal pallet awaits. Each crate, as tediously as they were loaded, is carefully unloaded and placed on the pallet. When the cargo plane lands in a couple hours, the entire team will be loaded on for the quick trip to Anchorage.
They're pretty well traveled. This team's gone to Bethel a number of times for the Cusco 300. They've been here in Nome a couple times. Yeah. And so most of them just kind of sit in their crates and be quiet and calm down and no problem. They'll sleep all the way to Anchorage.
From there, some friends will pick up and drive Dunham's dogs back to their home in Willow. In the meantime, Dunham plans to wait for the rest of the field to make it to Nome. The race culminates with the finisher's banquet on Sunday, a catered dinner event with awards and speeches from each musher. Dunham's first time running the Iditarod came back in 2020, but she scratched out of Unalakleet about three quarters of the way through the race. She came back in 2024 and successfully reached the Nome finish line. Dunham returned in 2025, but scratched after over 500 miles on trail. This was Dunham's first Iditarod since her father died in January. She says he introduced her to the world of mushing at the Copper Basin 300 over three decades ago.
I remember meeting, like, now they're all the historical mushers, right? Like, yeah. Susan Butcher and Allie Zirkel and Martin and all of those guys were there.
Before his passing, Dunham's dad asked her to carry his ashes on the trail this year. Not to be spread, but to just go for one last ride with his daughter. Dunham says she felt his presence on a dark night when an especially vibrant aurora lit up the sky. As she watched her dogs quietly trot on the trail ahead, her father's favorite song, Big Iron by Marty Robbins, started playing through her headphones.
To the town of our free, who rode a stranger one
I think that was just like a really great experience in the moment. And it may have just been coincidental, but I feel like it was more spiritual that his song came on, and then as soon as that happened, the Northern Lights just blew up like that.
There among them had a big iron on his hip. Big iron.
All that came to my head, I just said, thank you, Dad. You know, and it was just like just a lot of peace and love and gratefulness.
Dunham admits she didn't get to spend as much time prepping for this year's race as she would have liked. Instead, spending as much time with her father as possible. From the start, her goal was simply to finish and make good on that promise to bring him along for the ride.
Big iron on his hip, big iron on his hip.
Reporting blocks from that finish line in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
For KFSK, I'm Taylor Heckert.